everyone to this afternoon panel discussion. I'm very happy that I'll be able to chair it. My name is Roberta Meyerhofer. I'm a professor of American Studies and director of the Center for Inter-American Studies at the University of Graz. We have had sort of the tasks provided for us to talk about political trust on trial. Trial already a term that comes actually from the legal setting, and we will be discussing with one person who's here next to me and two people that are online connected already. We will be talking about global perspectives on trust, power and democracy. And those of you who were already here to the talk of Professor Preinsack, she actually already set the stage in many aspects that we will be touching upon from very specific perspectives. She mentioned also, and you might have seen it in the program, Pippa Norris, that talked about the problem of low trust. And then she also sort of positioned that as the problem of trustworthiness, which of course is connected, but actually positions it in terms of trust as a value, and trust being valuable enough to be used and implicated in the political and institutional settings. So I'm happy to introduce to you, sitting next to me already, Gwanza Gwertzentelli, and she will be sort of highlighting the aspect of corruption in terms of climate policy and international cooperation. And she's really well versed to do that because she's a researcher with Transparency International's Climate Governance Integrity Program and is situated in Berlin. She holds a PhD in International Development Studies from Roskilde University, where she already engaged in research of state environmental and climate governance within authoritarian political structures in Vietnam. Gwanza's research focuses on accountability in climate governance, international climate cooperation, just transition, state-society relations, and the dynamic of authoritarianism. So please help me in welcoming Gwanza to this panel. Now already, if some of you have Professor Preinsack's talk in mind, there is of course, when we talk about the lack of trust and trustworthiness missing, there is of course sometimes a moment of despair. Gwanza will be talking about corruption, so not necessarily reasons for hope. But therefore we have Lukas Hermesmeyer here with us via video stream. He's smiling, so I take that as another sign of hope, because he's going to talk to us about social movements in the US as grassroots movements. In the description, to me at least, it sounds like a hopeful statement. He already indicates in his movements with the head that this might be a little more ambivalent than I'm positioning it now. He is now joining us from New York, where he is, of course, is in the midst of many of these discussion of do grassroots movements have the impact that we wish for? Are these the grassroots movements that we want? But he is observing as an independent journalist and author, U.S. politics and culture. He's worked for Zeit Online. He analyzes in different media publications, and he focuses in general on social movements and labor organizing. He's also an op-ed contributor for the New York Times, and he has written a book on uprising America's Neue Linke, so the New Left movement in the U.S., but published in 2022, and of course, as we know, the political scene is moving so fast that I'm sure he will give us an update on that. So please welcome Lukas to our panel discussion way out in New York. Another observer that is now joining us, not from the West, but the East, Paul Krissai, is at the moment in the Ukraine. He actually was going to be here with us in person on the panel, Elevate even had already booked him a hotel room, and he would have been coming back to Graz because he studied journalism in Graz. But as the fast-moving political scene and the challenges we're facing currently, where he had to sort of stay in the Ukraine and is joining us from the Ukraine. As I mentioned, he studied in Graz, but he's originally from Lower Austria, and he also studied in St. Petersburg. Some of you might know him from his reporting from Moscow. He has sort of headed the ORF, the Austrian television company's bureau in Moscow from 2021 on. He has received awards for his reporting, the Robert Hochner Special Prize, and he also was voted Journalist of the Year in Austria in 2022. He too has written a book. His book is on Russia from within, Russland von innen, which was published in 2023. And he will give us this perspective as an observer in the midst of the situation. And therefore, please welcome Paul, who's now at the moment in the Ukraine.
Hello.
In terms of the format, we have sort of agreed, the four of us, that we would have sort of a round of three questions and then open up the discussion for the audience that we have, and we will see that we will keep to the time. And in the terms of the first round of question, I have sort of suggested the question that we talk about what are sort of one or two points that are critical for political trust in terms of the individual work that I briefly sketched. So what is this aspect of trust? How important is it in terms of the own experience, in terms of the functions and roles that each of you have? And I will be I'll be starting with Gwanza here, and then we'll go to Lucas, and then Paul, and then we'll come back again to the next question. So Gwanza, what about trust and your work?
Thanks so much. I think it's a good start to start how do we understand trust and what really shapes trust in politics. And when I think about this, one of the first things also representing an organization called Transparency International that comes to my mind is transparency. Transparency of decision-making, transparency for the public to understand what decisions are made where and for whom. But when you really think about it, transparency itself is not enough to either generate trust or strengthen trust in politics. And indeed, if there's sometimes transparency can cause the distrust, depends on what kind of information we also see. I also think that trust can exist without transparency, given depending on the political settings of a given country. For example, in some of the one-party authoritarian states, in this case, countries like Vietnam or China, there might be a certain agreement between the state and society that would be, for example, the state delivering certain economic benefits to the society and the people staying out of politics. So there is the trust that the government would deliver results, but there is no transparency. So I think that it is important when we think about trust to also following the previous very interesting lecture that we just heard, to think about also how do we check this trust, so to think about accountability. And in this case, I think when we think about what really shapes trust is the ability for the public to be able to keep the powerful and ones who are in power into account. And then this leads me to an important concept that I would like to also mention that is related to my work, which is not trust in politics, but entrusted power. And in this case, power that the public entrusts to the ones that are being elected or that are in the government to make decisions in public's interest. And when the entrusted power is abused, this is when we have corruption, and this is how Transparency International also defines corruption: abuse of entrusted power for private gain. And we know that corruption can cause a crisis also within the democratic context, given that there is a perception, especially of corruption, or also like proven corruption cases resurface. This can lead to distrust in public institutions. A weakening of public institutions can also lead to corruption. So we also have this kind of a vicious cycle where lack of accountability leads to weakening of institutions leads to distrust, distrust leads further to lack of accountability, and so on. So within the democratic context particularly, accountability really can bring up a lot of these challenges that we are talking about today. And just to say also, in terms of climate change, one thing that is important to remember is that oftentimes the support for government, because climate change is not just a standalone issue, and it's very much connected to broader trust or broader accountability in a given system. So when we have a system that is already suffering from accountability and trust in government institutions, then this, of course, affects also how climate policies are perceived, how and whether or not there's a belief that as a given system is going to solve this issue.
Is your work a kind of disruption that leads to more trust? Would you see that as something that you effectively establish trust actually on the basis that you disrupt the usual flow?
Yes, you need to keep the power in check. So if you have, and this is what one of the biggest role of civil society organizations, that you act as a watchdog and you constantly keep the ones who are in the government at check, that there's a strengthened institutions and the strengthened integrity in the process. And without this accountability, it's a live process, so to say. It's not a static.
Okay, so Lucas, an observer, a journalist, where would you disrupt in your work in terms of trust?
Thank you, everybody. Hi, everybody in Graz. I'm going to start with something between despair and hope. I hope that's okay, Roberta, not only hope. Because I would say that living in the US has made me aware that political trust can only be achieved by something like a radical distrust, I would say. And by that, I not only mean a general, like generally critical view on things and political decisions, like questioning the decisions of your government, etc. I mean more that in the US, there are so many democratic institutions that are actually anti-democratic in a way and like not trustworthy, that it's that questioning that and reckoning with that fact is a crucial step. And if you look at the Supreme Court, right, it's made of 9 people, 6 of them being pretty reactionary, that hold an enormous amount of power, and within one session can get rid of like things and rights that people have fought for decades, for example, the right of abortions. If you look at the White House right now, if you look at something like the US Senate, these are institutions that are, in my view, in conflict with democracy, like democratic institutions in conflict with democracy. And it's almost alarming that so many people in America distrust these institutions, but it's also in a way a critical step to start there, right? They should not trust the Supreme Court in a way. So if you look at studies and polls, there is an alarming rate of distrust towards politics, towards the government. I think it's like 22% of US adults saying that they trust the federal government to do the right thing. 22, right? That's tiny. And to your second question, or to the question how that relates to my job, while like preparing for this panel, I was thinking about this one like paradigm or like, let's say, rule we have in writing and journalism that says show, don't tell, right? It says, it means basically that it's better to describe a scene viscerally and like in details to make sure what happens instead of just saying it's a magical evening, right? Like say what is actually magical and like make come up with details. And I would like to transport or relate that to politics. It's not enough if you have an election season every 4 years and then the candidate comes to your town and says, this is the magic of democracy, while there is actually no magic they feel between the 4 years and even in during the campaign. So I would say it's very necessary to fill these gaps, and like it's more important to actually to do democracy than just to constantly hear that there isn't democracy or it's great to vote and everything. So that is one of the reasons I'm so interested in certain grassroots movements, in certain local organizations, in unions, where people actually have told me over the years so many times, being part of an organizing effort, being part of a strike, was the first time they actually felt democracy in the US. That's when I remember talking to Amazon labor union members, the people in Staten Island, New York, who were who achieved to form the first union within the company, within Amazon. And they said that was the first time they felt this like democracy pretty alive. And I think that's what is missing, and that's what gives me hope that these grassroots movements, these organizations, unions are experiencing a revitalization and have seen a rise in the last years. And maybe we can talk about the content or like different organizations later. But that's my first thoughts on that.
Okay, just a quick sort of clarification question, because of course grassroots is already an ambivalent term, because they can be actually institutional structures already, or they can be sort of more spontaneous. And in a way, an NGO like Transparency that Kwanza works for has already a certain institutional structure. As a non-governmental level. But of course, the grassroots can also be more spontaneous. Would you just quickly talk about that briefly?
Sure, and I do mean both, right? If I think about the union world, for example, there are unions that exist that have been around for decades and such a long time, and they can play a crucial role. But what has been so interesting about the last years is that there are new unions that are a little bit less institutionalized, but also so much more working through like direct democracy, where basically everywhere, that's not like a bit of staff and they do all the decisions, where every union member is doing the union, right? And I think both like very institutionalized and less so institutionalized grassroots or like non-parliamentary organizations do play a critical role. I would say both.
Thank you. We'll move to Paul. Yes, thank you for being back. What is your take in terms of being a journalist from within, where for different reasons there are restrictions on how you observe, how you can observe, how you then sort of talk about it? How does that influence your work in terms of the trust that you place into the institutions and the structures that you're faced with?
Hi, first of all, hi from Kyiv, the capital of Ukraine. It's a pleasure to be with you, although I, of course, would have loved to be with you in person in my beloved city of Graz. I hope we'll be able to do that next time. For the time being, before I go into your question, I just want to describe to you what things are like over on this side of the world. It's been the second air raiding alert in Kyiv today. It was just about an hour ago. Don't worry, I'm safe, but you hear the sirens every day for several times when Russian rockets or drones are being shot at Ukraine. Now, just this this whole atmosphere here in Ukraine, where I'm fortunate enough to have spent the last week studying how actually trust can turn into distrust really quickly. This is just a super interesting place at the moment to see how geopolitics really plays out on a personal level. I was at a flea market today in the outskirts of Kyiv, where they sell old Soviet things like vintage furniture, books and badges. And I was just going there to listen a little bit to what the talk of town is, what people are talking about. And as a matter of fact, at the moment, you hear basically two last names a lot in private conversations in Kyiv, and those last names are Zelensky and Trump, because those two presidents and their basically unprecedented fallout in front of the media just 1 week ago, this whole situation has really, really shaped the discourse here in Ukraine. What I mean is that what I literally heard today in the flea market were old men chatting about how Trump and Zelensky just have to meet up now and they're going to end the war. Then the other guy disputed that and said, no, that's never going to happen, because you can try and end it, but without any security guarantees, it's going to continue. And I think this fallout in front of the media that we've probably all seen last week, the way that Trump and his vice president and his entire team publicly humiliated Zelensky, using obviously a lot of the usual array of lies and untruths. This just goes to show how quickly the overwhelming trust that Ukrainians have put into the U.S. Literally, if you went up to any Ukrainian a week ago and asked and just mentioned the United States of America, they would have said, yes, thank you for being such an ally. Thank you for sending help. There was a lot of gratitude that has been shown also on a personal level. And after this kind of like a U-turn that Trump has been taking, siding with Vladimir Putin and all the things that we've been hearing him say, there's quite a major distrust now in how predictable a partner and ally the U.S. can be. And obviously, as we all know, Ukraine without the U.S. support is in a very bad place. Right now, with the military aid being cut off or paused, as they say, that's something that will have consequences that will lead to more loss of life. So this is how geopolitics often really plays out on a concrete personal level. People are afraid of what's going to come next. They are no longer very hopeful in any peace deal that might be facilitated by the United States. Much to the opposite, I think there is a vague hope for Europe to step in, for Europe as the closest partners on the continent to fill the gap that the U.S. has been leaving. On another level, from my sort of previous life as a reporter in reporting on Russia and other countries of the former Soviet Union, I spent 4 years covering Russia, and I think when we talk about political trust in Russia, that's something that's, well, it seems like it's almost an alien term, because much to the opposite of the Ukrainian example, where in 2014 Ukrainians really did stand up and rise up against a pro-Russian then president who tried to avoid Ukraine going into a pro-European direction. And then they really turned things around, and that's something that people really also on a personal level believe in. So the trust in institutions went up from there. The trust in the president is quite high at the moment, much to the contrary of what President Trump claimed recently. The level of support of Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, is way higher than 4%. It's actually, according to recent figures by the Kyiv Institute of Sociology, it is about 65%. So trust in those institutions, especially also in the army and volunteers who help the fighting efforts, is very high. Then again, Russia, a completely different story and a completely different picture, where for me as a journalist, this trust was also something that I felt personally, when you know that as a journalist, you will probably be closely followed by some of the friendly employees of the FSB, being the security services of the Russian Federation, where you know that your reporting will, if it won't be hindered by the authorities, they will at least try and definitely collect everything that you have been reported, that you have been reporting, and possibly use it against you, possibly try and make up any bogus claims that you are not a real journalist, which is exactly what happened to my colleague Evan Gershkovich, who was imprisoned in Russia and released last year in a prisoner exchange. And the issue of trust or distrust in this case is also something that you feel on a very basic level in Russia all the time. Whenever you talk to people, it feels like there's a missing link between what people feel they have power over and what those in power are doing. It's often the most probably often heard sentence that I heard when I was interviewing just passersby in Moscow was this kind of, well, we can't make any difference because it's them deciding up there. Of course, in a democracy, this would normally not be the case, but since Russia has been transforming into a dictatorship over the last 25 years, clearly this link has just not withstood, and maybe it's never really been there, this understanding that many of us at least have in Western democracies, that whoever I vote for will make a difference towards a political direction of my desire. This is something that's obviously not happening in Russia. We do not know how high the trust levels of ordinary Russians towards their own politicians really are. There are numbers, but they are to be treated with caution. I can quote the numbers of Levada Center. That's a center for sociology that is probably the most independent and one of the few ones that are still working in Russia. And they at the moment claim that Vladimir Putin has a trust approval rate of 83%. Again, this is to be treated with extreme caution. I think Russia is an example of a state where the social contract that has been mentioned before by my colleague on stage, the social contract between the ordinary people and those in power, meaning if you don't get tangled up in politics, we'll provide you with stability, with wealth, all of those things. This social contract that used to exist in Russia is no longer effective because Vladimir Putin has done everything for this equation to actually not work anymore, because what he's offering is no longer any stability. It's a completely unclear future for people in Russia, whether they support the war, which a lot of them do, or they don't. They still will have an equally unclear picture of their own future. And in return, they just, well, they have to go into the fighting if Russia decides for them to do so, because the mobilization efforts are still ongoing. So I think Ukraine and Russia are two quite different and opposing examples of how political trust and distrust can work out.
Okay, thank you. It seems that sort of the first round has already shown there's a difference in terms of the telling and the showing, as Lukas sort of pointed out. Paul already sort of also talked about it. There's perhaps also not always a trust in people saying what they are in their functions as a journalist. There can be a sort of a hidden distrust if someone says there's a journalist, but the system doesn't accept it. And in many ways already, the first round already showed that this personal trust and political trust as two different sort of systems is always also connected to power. So we'll perhaps now, in the next round, talk a little bit about this aspect of power, which Paul already sort of indicated in depth. What does that mean then, this very close connection, not just political power, but also political power in terms of individual lives, in terms of what you do. Kwanza, can we start with you?
I think here in this, from the point of view of my work, I think it's important to think about how trust and power again relate, and how power can operate without trust. For example, if we think about power as an influence over decision making, if we think about power as a control over certain resources, ability to shape politics, then in a democratic context or also not democratic context, we can have a lot of actors in the society that might have this power that are not elected, that are not representative to any group. And in the case of climate policymaking, for example, we often hear about the influence that certain interest groups, in this case, fossil fuel industry, or often we also call big polluters, so companies or businesses that are most at fault and at most guilty of emitting a lot of CO2 in the atmosphere, and how they relate and what their relationship is like to politicians. One of the biggest distrust, also nationally and also internationally, in climate policymaking is exactly this kind of ambiguous relationship. We often call this undue influence, so influence through, it might be legal means, like in a democracy it can be lobbying, contribution to the political campaigns, through industry associations. However, when the resources and influence is so skewed towards certain interest groups, then we can talk about undue influence. We can also talk about policy capture or regulatory capture, state capture. There's many different ways we can talk about this influence. But specifically in climate governance, this is one of the biggest sources of distrust, that the interest groups are skewing the have been from the beginning of the from the down of climate policies, at first denying actively climate change, then nowadays they don't deny anymore, but they try to delay or dilute ambition of climate policies. And this is happening at the national level, but also internationally in negotiations at the UN climate conferences. And we know, for example, that now in the last few years we already have a we have achieved one of the demands for different activists to actually disclose the affiliation of certain people who attend the climate negotiations, and we can see how many are linked with the industry, fossil fuel industry, and some of them are even part of the national delegations that are supposed to be negotiating to solve climate change, but have a huge conflict of interest with this goal. So. So we can see this kind of power that is working without being entrusted by anyone, but working to somehow delay what is supposed to be a public good for everyone.
Lucas, in your term, there might not be enough influence if you look at the grassroots movement, not undue influence that Kwanza is talking about, but perhaps not enough influence, or not perhaps influence, not enough power to sort of change or sort of position the policies that are discussed on grassroots levels. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, that's right. Like the US left I've been describing in my book and I report on is not in power, right? They're quite small compared to both the Republican Party on the right and the Democratic Party in the center. If you think about certain movements, Black Lives Matter, or like someone like Bernie Sanders, or different unions, as I described, they are like in an absolute underdog position. I would say, though, that the victories on the left, or like when it came to challenging power, we've seen the last years, they only they only happened when people came together and organized. Like that's someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who people might know, the left-wing parliamentarian from New York. Like she only came to she only won her election in 2018, I think it was, because grassroots people came together and like helped her canvassing and everything. So like I think challenging power from outside only starts with grassroots organizing, actually. I would like to add to that that in the US we could think and talk about like two different wings of power, right? Like if we stick to the two-party system that unfortunately exists in many ways, like the Republicans and the Democrats. And I would say, to be honest, that both of them are responsible for the very little distrust, like in different ways and in different scale. The Republicans far more. Like, I mean, people like Trump and Musk now, they're literally like instrumentalizing distrust, right? That is their game. They do chaos right now in order to govern, right? That is definitely part of the play. But if it comes to the liberal center and the Democrats, I think there's also so much responsibility, if you look at the last 40, 50 years, in not building trust, right? Like in doing certain, I would call it neoliberal policies that have been like privatizing public infrastructures, cutting down public and social programs, all of that in the last 40 years has not building trust. And when Bernie Sanders, for example, said after the election in November that like there's no surprise if you abandon the working class for 40 years that the working class abandons you, I think that is a spot on analysis. Like the Democrats are not really trusted either. And I think it is crucial to see both forces and the responsibility of both forces, not only the right in manipulating and instrumentalizing distrust, but also the center, also the Democrats who have been failing. That would be my first thoughts.
So, Paul, you already talked about power a lot in your first statement. And of course, there's a very different positioning in authoritarian systems. Is in your case, can you relate that now also this question of power to democracy in terms of observing authoritarian systems?
Well, I think what Russia as an example shows pretty clearly is that you don't need trust to be in power. When I reported on Russia and I reported especially a lot of those court cases against Russian opposition politicians. One of them was Vladimir Karamurza, a pretty well-known opposition politician who was charged and on trial in the year of 2023. I was sitting in this courtroom and watching on with a lot of foreign diplomats, a lot of foreign journalists, as Vladimir Karamurza was within 2 minutes sentenced to a 25-year jail sentence. And this was a prime example of how a court that was not trusted or believed by anybody, really. I mean, it was a complete farce from the beginning to the end, and it was clear to everybody who participated in it, including most likely the employees of the court, because what they do is they just fulfill orders of the Kremlin. It sounds banal, but it is pretty much like that. They're not trusted by anybody. They're not given really any legitimation by any power that would be legitimate through voting. But still, they have the power to sentence people to, well, Stalinist sentences, like in Vladimir Karamurza's case, who went to jail and only through luck, really, and through the lobbying of European politicians, was freed in this major prisoner exchange in August of last year. Another example would be Vladimir Putin himself. He does not need the trust of the people, although he seemingly has it, at least of some kind of majority. Again, we have to be cautious with the numbers, but I, from my own impression, I do think that a majority of Russians do prefer Vladimir Putin to any alternative, because there really seems to be no alternative, which is part of the whole unique selling proposition of Putin himself, that he effectively murdered or jailed all of the alternative candidates who could have ever really become dangerous for him. Prime example being Alexei Navalny, who died about a year ago in a prison colony in the north of Russia. But still, Vladimir Putin, be it with the trust of the population or without, he is in power because he has obviously long ago gotten rid of any institutional mechanisms and basic democratic institutes such as elections that really deserve the name. He's still holding those elections, and we've seen them last year, which is more of an exercise to show to basically his elites and those who support him, but also to the general population, that he is supposedly a legitimate leader. But again, trust and power, I think, are two things that are ideally connected, and in a working democracy, they should obviously come as a pair. But authoritarian regimes show that this is by far not the norm, and actually it seems like it's becoming more of an exception by the day, because I think we all see that even in Western democracies and in European countries, trust in democratic institutions and in politicians is going down.
Yeah, thank you very much. We'll now sort of go to the third round of questions, and I'll ask you to speculate perhaps on the prognosis of trust, also perhaps to speculate in terms of do we need the trust? Paul again sort of talked about power without trust. Is a trust just a part of democratic institutional structures, or is it the basis for it? And I'd be interested in your thoughts, and I will start with Gavanza again.
It's difficult to think about future, especially like at this time, hearing also this reports from, on one hand, US, and on the other hand, Ukraine and everything that's happening. But I can also add to the gloom a bit and think about how declining trust also in democracies, and like I talked about in the beginning, how maybe like perception of corruption and trust might be linked. When we see that the corruption is growing, or when we perceive that the corruption is growing, this might lead to further decrease in trust. And what we see, at least from our research on corruption perception around the world, and what is really worrying, is that we can see that one of countries that have one of the steepest decline in their score, so basically that are increasingly perceived more corrupt, are Western democracies. This is not to say that they score lower than some of the other countries, but still it seems like they are losing their, so the public is losing somehow, or like public is perceiving the countries in the West more corrupt. And for example, Austria, I just checked this morning, and it lost 4 points in the corruption perception index just last year. So I think for trust to return, or I think it is important to trust with accountability, there has to be like a reason to trust, and we need to know this reason. But for this, we need to also see that these institutions are trustworthy. And when we talk about like climate as well, we need to see results. We need to see that the decisions that are made are ambitious, that they promote the rights and positions of the vulnerable groups that are the most affected by climate change, that the wealthier countries deliver on climate targets on one hand, but also for the support that they're supposed to provide for the more like poor and less capable countries to adapt, and that the support that is provided is also like not necessarily done in a way that, again, it benefits the donor countries, like, for example, through loans, or but more like grants that are for the local population to use as they wish, as they see fit.
Gwanta, just a follow-up question, because it seems this aspect of trust is on different levels, because it seems, especially in view of climate challenges and the immediacy that we've heard now from our other, from the US and from the Ukraine, it needs also a trust that certain topics that are challenging immediate topics still, like climate change, aren't sort of backgrounded, are no longer as important because of the immediacy of all the other political challenges. Is this a different form of trust that we sort of expect political institutions, structures, politicians to keep also all of the important topics in the view?
Yeah, I think this is very difficult. Because I think it is really true that some, because of ongoing geopolitical crisis, certain topics that actually require cooperation internationally are suffering. And just like first day of Donald Trump's presidency, he also withdrew from the Paris Agreement. Today I read this morning that US stopped one of the biggest funding climate finance initiatives that in last years they have promised they stopped funding this. I think it's difficult to think about trust also internationally between the nations when there, this kind of promises are being backtracked, and also other like very pressing topics are in the forefront. So this is why I was saying that trust in climate-related institutions cannot be separated also from like broader trust in policies, politics, institutions in democracies, or just globally as well in multilateral institutions.
So Lukas, a grassroots movement, the immediacy of being in the United States, will trust be regained? How do you sort of, what is your prognosis?
I'm not that hopeful, to be honest. And I would like to emphasize one more time that I really think that we do need a certain amount of distrust in order to rebuild trust. Like, while the Republicans, as we can all see, have turned into a cult, basically, and are like on so many levels deeply anti-democratic, I personally also don't trust the Democratic Party to get the country back on track. I think they are too tame. I think they are too elitist. I think their program is not really convincing economically. They're not rooted within the working class of that country. And I think if you ask what we need, I would try to stress the point that we need a radical democratization of all aspects of life. Like, I do believe in representative democracy, but I also think we need far more direct democracy, like far more places and spaces and structures where people can actually enact a will and can like come together and like co-govern, right? There can be like citizen assemblies or councils or community meetings that can be, I'm thinking about an idea by the German sociologist, I forgot his name, Stefan Mau, who's saying like, why don't we in Germany, why don't we have like a third chamber made out of like citizens, right? Like besides the Bundestag and the Bundesrat, why not a chamber that's both demographically representative but also chosen by sortition? Why is that not like a pillar of our democracy where people come together and change them after maybe whatever 2 or 3 years? And I think that kind of like radical democratization of all aspects of life is what we need. And I would definitely add and emphasize as well economically, like we need democracy in the workplace, we need strong unions, we need better labor protections, we need more cooperatives. Like if you spend all your day in a structure where like the CEO earns billions or millions and you basically only not even have the minimum wage. It's like, this is not building trust, right? Like, I just don't want to reduce it to this aspect of like parliamentary or like electoral politics, let's say that. And maybe as a final thought, I was thinking yesterday about Peter Thiel, right? This like Silicon Valley tech investor who has been turned into this patron of the far right, like a pretty despicable person in many ways, how he's like interacting within politics. He said once that democracy and freedom, into his mind, are not compatible. And what he meant is that his idea of freedom, right, like absolute market fundamentalism, like no restrictions for companies, you only get that against the will of the masses, against democratic institutions. And I think, while I think he's completely wrong how he means it, he's also accidentally right. Like, this kind of capitalist structures will not allow democracy. Like, we live in an economy in the US that like is absolutely in conflict with democracy. And I think we have to reckon with that, and we have to rebuild trust in a very different way, and not just like believe in the existing institutions, just build something new. And that can be unions, that can be a more, you know, like active democratic party, that can be community organizations that actually come together and think, how do we do democracy and not just like claim democracy? I think that's the crucial point.
Because we would have to challenge these definitions of freedom and democracy, not just sort of take them as if we all know what we're talking about. So, and in addition, perhaps one of the meeting points would be the town halls that we're also watching in Europe unfold. So that might be sort of voices of democratic public that also have certain places. Paul, your sort of platform could be the market you were talking about, the Ukrainian market, where you heard all these different voices, and perhaps sort of that is also an engagement in a democratic discussion that journalists might then bring to the forefront. But what is your prognosis?
Before I give my prognosis on trust, and I'd like to talk about it more on a geopolitical level, I would like to show you something if I can. I think I can change the camera here. Yeah, so what you see here, hopefully you can see this, is the 8-lane Khreshchatyk Street in the center of Kyiv. It's kind of like the main road here. And this is where about 1 to 6 times a day funerals are held. You see, like, there would be a big pickup truck with loudspeakers, and the coffin of the soldier, who is typically a young male, typically from Kyiv, would be carried through the whole city. You would have cars stopping, you would have people kneeling down to pay their respects. And this is something that disrupts everyday life in Kyiv a couple of times a day. I'm telling you this because this is the result of a geopolitical standoff, of a war that's been wielded by Russia on the basis of, let's face it, false impressions of the Russian history, and on basically based on a couple of lies that Vladimir Putin made up to legitimate his invasion of Ukraine. And for Ukrainians at the moment, I think the biggest issue is having their own men and people die every day at the front. And the world is talking about not so much that, it's talking about what will Trump and Putin talk about. Now, we can, of course, look to the dictator and the would-be dictator to, I don't know, make a deal or no deal or a deal that won't hold, because I think, frankly, Trump won't care. The guy, in my opinion, has a pretty much zero attention span. He's going to try and make a quick deal. He's going to try and do this very much in alignment with Putin, as far as we know at the moment, but we don't know whether it will even happen for real. What matters for people in Ukraine, and also in the end for us in Europe, is that there will be less funerals on this Khreshchatyk Road in the center of Kyiv, that there will be less funerals in Ukrainian villages that have all been affected by the war heavily. And I think for that to happen, we need to regain trust on a geopolitical stage, which means we need predictability. We don't need leaders that think that this is some sort of, I don't know, football game where you just take a shot and either you miss or you make a goal. This is about responsibility for entire nations that are at stake. And Ukraine at the moment is a nation that is at stake. And this is something that you can very clearly feel when you're here. And I invite really everybody who's listening to do so for themselves, because you don't need a visa to go to Ukraine. You can take a train. You can go to Kyiv. It is relatively normal here, the sort of everyday life. And there's a relatively good air defense system in place. And it's just vital, I think, to see with your own eyes what consequences the war in Ukraine has on not only the country itself, on Ukraine, but also on all the countries that are bordering it. And although Austria isn't directly bordering Ukraine, the Ukrainian border is closer to Graz than Bregenz is. So it's really an issue that very much is something that really is important for everybody, for all of us. And I think instead of looking for two, well, let's face it, relatively old white men to kind of figure out the geopolitical questions of the day, and doing so in a logic of the 19th century where you would just kind of part Europe into influence zones, I think we should really think more about the funerals that are happening every day in Ukraine.
Thank you, Paul, for reminding of us and bringing that to us with such clarity. It seems sort of that all three panelists did sort of ask for individual engagement, public engagement in different ways. But of course, Paul, your sort of real important appeal to remember that it's on different levels, these personal involvements, but personal involvement is always possible. And we'll move now to the personal involvement of the audience here, because we now have half an hour to open up the floor, and you can sort of put, I see already some in the audience, and we'll see then how we can sort of, who addresses the questions best.
All right. Okay, you can hear me? Perfect. First of all, thank you so much to everyone for your highly interesting contributions. I was wondering about the effect of affect on trust, because if we look at how we build trust across our lifespans, typically the first people in power who we trust are our parents. And in psychology, we talk about attachment styles and children trusting in their caregivers. And that's the first kind of trust we build, which is very effective in nature. Now, if we're talking about politics and other forms of power, the question to me is just, in how far is there a certain effective component to trust as well? So what roles do emotion play when we are talking about people in power and the trust we place in them, and also should they play a role at all? Should that be a matter of emotions? Because often we tend to associate rational aspects more so with political trust and things like that. And if not, how can we compensate that? Because somehow affect seems to be tied to trust quite a lot in our everyday lives.
You want to start?
I think this is not really like a question in the way that you can say emotions matter or not, because they do matter, and we know this. We know that the way people vote and the support they place into different politicians, it's often based on an emotional response as well. It's not always rational, so to say, what's best for what will be best for me. When I think about also on from my point of view to talk about like climate politics, and I remember reading this study. I forgot now the author's name, but I can, if somebody's interested, I can share later. That there was this basically like people who already trust the government, they would support the climate policies if they adopt the climate policies. But if they already distrust the government, then even though they believe in science and maybe like on conceptual level they do believe in climate change, they might still oppose the kind of policies that the government opposes proposes. So I think this shows that emotionally how we relate to the government, it also kind of like dictates how we relate to the certain policies they propose. And of course it also makes sense because, I mean, it's not just on climate change, it's also on different economic policies and so on, but it makes sense because if we distrust the source of powers and whatever good they might propose or make us believe that this is what you need, then this we would question as well.
Seems we might need a definition of emotions, and what Paul actually was asking us is empathy. So Lukas, what do you think in your grassroots observations? Empathy, emotions, lack of rationality?
I think the question is very interesting and crucial, and starting with my maybe first personal thoughts is that I trust politicians far more when they do show some emotions, to be honest. If they don't always suppress what they're feeling, that is might be a personal thing. But I think that is, since we are, what a banal statement, but since we are such emotional human beings, why would we want to alienate that from the realm of politics, right? Like I'm obviously glad that like not every press conference and statement of a politician is like guided by strong emotions, but like suppressing that doesn't seem helpful to me either. And if I think about what politicians, for example, I trust, one thing that comes to mind is that it is in cases of dissent where I like disagree some with someone's decision or stance position that are still able to comprehend the decision, right? Like, that I still can like make sense where it comes from. And I think that is a key part of trust in general and democracy, that even if you don't agree, you do understand how the decision was made, and that's connected to what other people said, right? Transparency, like how transparent are certain democratic processes. And I do want to understand where that person actually stands, like how that position has been formed and developed. And I think that's where like emotions or effects, or like at least like showing some of that does play a role.
Paul, perhaps you might want to also comment on this, because it seems sometimes it's staged emotions, sometimes on situation with Trump and Zelensky have by observers also been seen that this was a game of showing emotions that might not necessarily been there. Any thoughts on this aspect of emotions?
I mean, I think the dispute between Trump and Zelensky actually helped Zelensky domestically and has actually increased his popularity here in Ukraine. But when I think about emotions in terms of the political process, of course, in an ideal world, I would love for us all to read through the programs of all the parties and then vote accordingly. In a less ideal world, which is obviously reality, probably that won't be the case, and probably emotions will play a role. In the maybe least ideal world, which are, in my opinion, authoritarian regimes, dictatorships, I think regimes are actually really very much using emotions to stay in power, which is exactly what Vladimir Putin has been doing for 25 years, suggesting to everybody that without me, you're going to be way worse off, although nobody really knows whether that's true, and where often not only emotions are what decides elections, but also literally money. When we were covering regional elections in Russia, that was before the war in 2021 that we were in the city of Saratov, which is at the huge Volga River in the center of Russia, quite a majestic place, actually. We were talking to pensioners there just ahead of the elections and asking them who they would be voting for. And they said, well, obviously for Putin, because he just sent us 10,000 rubles. Because obviously Putin, before the elections, knows very well to give out small gifts in the form of small subsidies to his main electorate, which is mostly teachers and other government officials, but also others who work for the state. And I think very often a mix of emotions and helping that with gifts like that is what can make a difference and what can actually destroy a political system that should be ideally based on facts and figures, again, in an ideal world.
Okay, thank you. So more questions, statements, yes.
Thanks. What resonated with me especially is this aspect of making and showing democracy as compared to just telling democracy. And I would like to hear your opinions or your impressions of what role journalism and media could play more constructively in doing this. And this is based on one observation in elections in Germany. In the television debates before the election, almost the only moment when other topics than migration were discussed was when citizens were allowed to ask questions to the politicians. So they asked about social questions and climate change. And for a lot of people in Germany I talked to, this was a very wholesome moment, reestablishing some trust in their fellow citizens, but also showing that they didn't trust the journalists nor the politicians to talk about it, like to represent these topics. And there was a, like, it felt like the media was mainly telling the doom of democracy instead of playing their part as the fourth power in democracy.
Okay, so Lukas or Paul, would you like to start?
Please go ahead.
Should I go ahead?
Sure.
I think thank you for the question, what you brought up as an example from Germany is so telling, right? That like it is so worthy to sometimes check the discrepancy between what certain talk shows, certain also politicians and parties talk about and what people are actually thinking about and what are worried about. And like, I would never deny that migration is a challenge to many people in Germany, and that is not considered a problem. It is considered by many people a problem. But if you really, and I spent some time in winter in Germany and talked to many people about that, what they often mean is like, we need more resources in schools, in communities and everything, in certain infrastructures. And that's the main thing. And if you talk to someone longer than 5 minutes and they'd get over maybe get beyond certain resentment and certain like ideas, you'll get to that point often, right? You understand what like the problem of migration does actually mean. And I think your example is telling. If you give people the chance to ask questions, maybe they have different priorities than what journalists and politicians, I want to be self-critical, both sometimes think are the main problems.
Paul, do you want to come in on this?
I think right now, I didn't cover the German elections as much, but I think it's a very valid point. I think what's an underlying issue is the constant pace of news that's coming in. And I think a lot of us, including me, charged as guilty as charged, as they say, including me, I try to also sometimes take my break from the news when I'm off of work, because with any Trump tweet, or be it Truth Social posts are becoming a headline, then the next moment he will say the complete opposite on air. Then media are going berserk, literally, about how to interpret this. The next day, he will have forgotten about what he said. Again, I'm just picking out Trump as a probably one of the most visible example and, well, let's face it, the most powerful man in charge at the moment. But I think in general, I think we as a media are in a quite challenging place to, on the first, like on the one hand, we have to portray what's being said and what's going on, because otherwise, I mean, you can't not report on it. But often when I see headlines like Trump said this or that, and I often, especially when it's in a Russia-Ukraine context, I would see immediately that a lot of the facts aren't straight. A lot of this actually would require a fact check rather than normal reporting. Then we run into the conflict of often not enough time, not enough space, in especially in TV, to make these big elements, these big segments with including fact checks, although obviously that's what we would be doing. It's what I'm trying to say is that, yes, this is a challenge, and I think this is very much a wake-up call to us as journalists to try and figure out how we can make formats that give more analysis, more fact-checking, and less of the breaking news kind of chit-chat that I think drives everybody crazy. On the other hand, of course, yes, we need to be fast. We need to hold the pace. Again, I think it's a conflict, a conflict of interests, maybe even, to be fast on the one hand, but also be as critical, as analytical as possible. And in the end, I think if we don't really manage to obviously reach our audiences, because audiences will start avoiding the news because it's becoming too much, there's not enough guidance of what to make of all of this, then I think we'll have a problem for democracy as well. Because if media aren't being trusted, be it because of their own work or because of the content that they have to transport, then we will be more and more in a place where everybody just, as is already the case, is just basically creating their own echo bubble, their own bubble on social media, where they receive news that fits their worldview. But we won't really have what I think is essential in any democracy, which is a basic understanding of certain facts on the grounds of which we can have a discussion.
But it seems we're back to the trust question in terms of trusting that we can talk, as Lucas said, about challenging issues without immediately sort of expecting others already to provide the solutions. It seems that if you, Paul, sort of are very self-critical towards journalists, I would challenge that a little, because we do need to know what's going on, and perhaps we should not sort of expect journalists to provide constantly also the mediation to solutions, but we perhaps have to build a basis of trust to address issues that we can not necessarily solve, like climate change. And it seems we're back to this one issue that all of you addressed, and that's the public involvement, the individual's involvement in these issues. I also want to mention that you can pose a question or make a statement in German. You don't have to do it in English. If anyone would like to sort of say something in German, that's fine too, because all three panelists do speak German, yes. Some perhaps with a German accent, but the Austrians will manage, yeah. Okay. Any other questions?
If I may add one thing, yes, I was also thinking, this is not really part of my expertise, but one thing that came to my mind while others were also talking is the need for more like local reporting as well. So not just like nowadays, even like if you go to your local media, you see the headlines of what Trump tweeted on Truth Social. But this building trust and transparency in what actually concerns our life. It's like maybe it's like in our municipality or in our commune or a city level and so on. And I think the need for understanding of also what's happening and what's important at this level. I think one of the things that we have witnessed, at least in last decade, is this deterioration of the local media reporting and only like being news being only this kind of national or international. So I think like from the point of view like investigative journalists at the local level, which is really important also for anti-corruption work and yeah.
Do you want to say a short closing statement? Because we'll go around.
Yes. Just to summarize also what was said, I think trust itself is a huge source of power. So one thing that I was thinking about also when I was listening to the previous talk and even now, it's very important for us to also be responsible of who do we give this trust and how do we hold the trust powers that we trust accountable later. So it's also very much linked to the responsibility also from the citizen's side, but also from the politicians or the state side.
Thank you, but I see that someone has the microphone, so I was too early with the closing statement.
Hello, can you hear me? Microphone is off, right?
1 second.
Hello?
Take this one, if in doubt.
So my question can be heard on the live stream, probably. I wanted to ask, so we talked a lot about Trump, but I think the audience here is rather unlikely to potentially vote for Donald Trump at such a festival. So I wanted to ask to turn around the perspective. Can you imagine some, to give examples, so people actually understand that such a commitment can hit both sides? What, for example, would be false narratives or problematic narratives that are more widespread among a typical left liberal leaning audience, such as this audience here, probably, that would also need to be challenged by journalism that does not just follow groupthink or bubble think? Is there something that comes to your mind?
It seems we're talking about the trust in this discussion. So is this an open discussion in terms of addressing issues? Paul, you look as if you're going to say something.
I think this was addressed to Lucas, probably, or was it addressed to all of us?
To all.
I'm gonna. Let you go ahead.
Okay, I can go ahead. I would say. Trying to address this panel and situation and room we are in, maybe it's a fair critique to say it's two journalists and someone who works in a nonprofit who are talking about democracy and trust and power, and not someone who has a more or like a different role within democracy. Right? That could have been also like a. At least a very interesting perspective to have someone who's a local politician or a community organizer or a union member and have like a very not only like an observing role, because I'm mainly an observer, and I think Paul is too, right? Where we have like our own opinions and everything, but we report and we try to contextualize, and to have that other perspective could have been helpful. Because too many panels, I think, and too many discussions are narrowed down to a certain amount of perspectives. That's maybe the one first thought I have.
And it also seems, if I may, to sort of contextualize it, that we're having this discussion within the Elevate Festival means that we're contextualizing it differently, that even a festival of this kind feels that there should be platforms which could be seen as platforms of involvement and engagement on those levels, and not just an exchange of set opinions, but an openness in this flow of the lives that we live, of gaining new information, new knowledge, new setups, new sort of networks, of sort of actually, in many ways, what we're doing is establishing a community where obviously, even if I have these distinguished panelists here, we won't have answers. We will just be able to engage on this level of sharing some ideas. And I think in terms of what we perhaps need is literacy more, perhaps political literacy, but perhaps also a community literacy, that we don't automatically always have to take a stance and say, this is where I am on a left, right, middle, up, down scale. But we can just engage in the issues that we sort of are supposed to be engaged with and are engaged with consciously or not. And it seems that's why it's so important to have also someone here on the NGO level that deals with something as big as climate change, where obviously we haven't found solutions, but obviously we have to take steps. So I've sort of lost my role as a moderator. Are there any more questions in German or English? French or Georgian? No? Okay, then I will. Do you want to do another final statement? No?
Just to say again, I think important with the trust and trust we give and trust that is placed in us, even depending on our role, to also think about the responsibility that comes with it.
Okay, so thank you. So Lukas, a final short statement.
Yeah, very briefly, maybe also mainly a repetition of what I said in a way, but like I think a certain distrust in the existing institutions when I think about the US is absolutely crucial. They are not trustworthy. They are often not democratic, and I don't want to be too general, but some of them really are not. Especially in the long run, it is worth to not just wait for better politicians, for like a party to change a little bit, maybe do democracy more from the ground, create structures or join structures where you can have a saying within certain community levels, obviously, especially. And I think adding or like following up with what someone in the audience said, like it is worth for journalism to always reflect on how much we just like follow a certain discourse, or if how much we actually engage with people and their worries, and not just like repeat what's already been claimed by certain politicians as a problem. Challenge what the actual problem is maybe the last thought.
Okay, thank you. Paul, as a last statement.
Since I read the words trust issues on stage behind you, from what I see here, I think these trust issues are something that is to be taken very seriously. I have the transatlantic trust and relationship, the formerly trustful relationship in mind. I think we're living through quite interesting times in terms of how the world is changing, and I know this is an extremely, extremely often used phrase, but I think there are some major changes at the moment that we should not be overlooking. The major change is that one of the formerly most reliable Western countries and one of the most powerful is seemingly switching sides, or at least pretending to, towards the authoritarian and dictator regimes of this world. This is something that will not only have consequences for the US, but also for countries that have been allies with them, including Europe, including Austria. But it's something that will also have consequences on others that are looking on as things are developing. I'm thinking about China, who, well, as if I was in charge of the Chinese Communist Party or head of state there, I would be looking very closely at how Putin is possibly gonna get away with the invasion of Ukraine with impunity. And this is something that will just serve as an example for other nations in the world in terms of military aggression. I don't want to spread panic or make everybody go out of this session in depression, but I want us to really remind ourselves of what's at stake at the moment. And I might be a little bit under the effect, under the emotions of seeing a lot of these things play out on a very daily and basic level here in Ukraine. But I also spend a lot of time in Austria reporting from there. And I think it's very important that we don't lose sight of what's happening at the moment, which means become more self-sustainable as Europeans. And I don't think there's any other way. I'm in no way a politician, but I think this is just the clear analysis from a European standpoint. We will have to support Ukraine and fill the void that the US is leaving. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be cheap. It's going to be the exact opposite. But if we don't do that, Putin won't stop in Ukraine. And again, this is from a standpoint of analysis, and I think that we have not lost the chance to act, but I think it's pretty late. And I think all of the beautiful statements and nice words that have been said over the last 3 years, ever since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, that we will stand with Ukraine as long as it takes and so forth, that stuff that's starting to sound a little old in the face of a challenge that is becoming bigger and bigger by the day. So I think we'll, as Europeans, have to continue to really step up our game. We'll have to show Ukraine that we don't think they're just a playing ball in some sort of soccer match. We will have to take this responsibility and thereby, and now we're turning to the key word, thereby reinstate trust, not only between Ukraine and Europe, but also I think for Europe to be a more trusted leader of the still remaining free world. And I think, yeah, that would be my last thoughts on that. Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, it's up to me now to thank the organizers for letting us discuss this in this way. I want to thank the audience for being receptive to something that the three panelists brought. It's not an abstract discussion, as we've heard, on three different levels. Perhaps the most sort of impressive, of course, is the immediacy that Paul brought to it, but also what Lucas talks about on the grassroots movements that he's observing and involved in the US. And of course, the climate discussion of Gwanza is also an important concrete level that takes this abstract aspect to the immediacy of our personal experiences. So please join me in thanking my three panelists, and we continue.
Thank you.